Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. For a long time, outer space was conceptually and legally a no man's land. That changed on October 4th, 1957, when the Soviet Union launched the Sputnik satellite into Earth's orbit, triggering an international space race and calls for binding laws to govern space exploration.
Until 2 days ago, that sound had never been heard on this Earth. Suddenly, it has become as much a part of 20th century life as the whir of your vacuum cleaner. It's a report from...
10 years later, the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 was ratified and has since facilitated smooth, peaceful interactions between nations capable of probing space. As the prospect of civilian space travel and settlement appears more accessible, international space law may be in need of revision. Joining us to discuss the field is Michael Lissner, president of the International Space Society Foundation. Michael, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
So how long after Sputnik was launched were proposals for space laws introduced?
Well, Sputnik was launched in 1957, and really at that point, they were just basically talking about who owned space or who could access space. And in fact, at that time, the Soviet Union basically had the theory that we own the territory all the way up from our ground all the way up into space. And this was a major conundrum because the United States was thinking about launching satellites as well. And the problem was, if we launch a satellite, they will say that we're invading, quote, their space every time our satellite goes over their territory.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they beat us to the punch by launching Sputnik in 1957. And they not only made a very big technical accomplishment, but they also provided a big legal accomplishment for the rest of the world. Because when Sputnik went into orbit, it started traversing over the territory of the United States and other countries as well. In fact, there was a story that after Sputnik launched, they said, well, Sputnik wasn't really revolving around the Earth. Earth was revolving around Sputnik. And that didn't hold up very well. And they basically had to concede that they created unintentionally what we call an international law customary norm that you have free access to outer space. Nobody owns it. Everybody is able to access space, even over flying over the territory of another country.
In those intervening years, though, from 1957 to 67, pretty problematic years in terms of U.S.-Soviet relations, was this all agreed upon internationally?
It was eventually. And during 57 and 67, when the Outer Space Treaty was drafted, there was a set of principles that were drafted by the United Nations. Those were actually culminated in 1967 with the Outer Space Treaty, which over 100 nations have signed, including the United States, what is now Russia, and China.
What are some of the overriding principles? I mean, the basics, sort of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967.
Well, the basic one most prominent is that outer space is the province of all mankind, meaning no one country owns outer space. It can't own the space above the territory. It can't own the moon. It can't own Mars. It can't own asteroids or any celestial bodies. It also has the principle that nations are responsible for the activities of their citizens. It also has a strict prohibition on the use of nuclear weapons in outer space as well.
All right. So how about liability? Especially we have so many commercial satellites now, you know, not sponsored by the state as they might have been in 1950s or 60s. Who would be liable then if, say, a satellite for a U.S. company re-enters the atmosphere and falls on a building in another country, for example, or if a TV satellite crashed into the Hubble telescope?
Let's address your first one, because this actually happened back in 1979. The Russians had a nuclear-powered reconnaissance satellite called Cosmos 954 that re-entered the atmosphere and landed in the northwestern territory of Canada and caused some pretty significant contamination. There is a treaty that was drafted and signed in 1972 called the Liability Convention. Now, under the Liability Convention, any object that causes damage on the surface of the Earth, the country that launched that is strictly liable. The two countries get together through their embassies, through their diplomatic organs, and they basically communicate to one another, hey, this has been a problem, and they negotiate back and forth through their diplomatic channels to make a resolution. This is what happened with Cosmos 954. Essentially, the Canadians found the wreckage. They identified it as belonging to that satellite. They went to the Russians through their embassy saying, hey, this caused some damage. And eventually they came to an agreement where the Russians paid costs for cleanup and other associated damage.
Mm-hmm. How about crashing into other space junk, the other scenario?
Well, that is the unknown. Under that scenario, it isn't a strict liability standard. It's almost like, let me say, a comparative negligence standard like we have here in New Hampshire for, say, an automobile accident.
Mm-hmm.
Each country or each party is apportioned damages based on their liability. Now, back in 2009, we actually had an incident where two satellites crashed over Siberia. They physically collided. There was a satellite from Iridium LLC, which provides cell phone services, and a dead Russian communication satellite. Afterwards, there was a lot of finger-pointing. The Russian Federation blamed Iridium LLC. Iridium LLC wasn't saying much about it. And there was a lot of back and forth. But it was never resolved who was really at fault, because at that time we didn't have what we call space situational awareness to really look at the tapes and understand what happened and who was responsible or how to apportion damages.
So I guess that leads to another question that maybe you can enlighten us on. What happens about ownership of that stuff that's just floating around in the atmosphere?
Well, that's a good question. I don't have an answer. Nobody has an answer yet. That's kind of the billion-dollar question. Who's responsible for all that junk up there? And this all goes back to the treaties themselves. The treaties, when they were drafted in the context of the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States. And both countries wanted to make sure they were ambiguous as possible so that they would have enough maneuverability so as to be able to perform their own national security functions, you know, without being constrained too much by the language of the treaties themselves.
Well, I want to get to more Cold War politics in just a minute, but first say that Michael Listener is with us. He's president of the International Space Society Foundation. He's a consultant on international space law. Now, Michael, while we were prepping for this segment, we read about a man named Dennis Hope. Now, he, in 1980, citing a loophole in the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, claimed ownership of the moon and has been selling it off in small parcels ever since. Now, I know you know about this guy. I guess he's famous in your circles, or infamous, let's say. We gave him a call and asked him how much an acre of his lunar property goes for.
If you were to buy a piece of property over the internet, it would cost you $36.50. If you bought five of those, it'd be $132.50. So far, we've sold about 675 celebrities like George Lucas, Ron Howard, Tom Hanks, Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman, Clint Eastwood, three former presidents of the United States, Carter, Reagan, and George W. Bush are all property owners. We have 1,800 major corporations that have purchased land from us, including the Hilton and Marriott hotel chains. I've had no governmental agencies challenge my claim of ownership in any regard whatsoever. I have a lot of individuals on the planet that are smarter than I am that tell me I can't do this. I guess in some regards I'm opportunistic, but it was an area of life that when I got involved in it, it seemed to be relevant at the time, and now it has more relevance than ever.
That's Dennis M. Hope. He's alleged owner of the moon and self-styled owner of the Lunar Embassy and president of the Galactic Government. So is what he's doing legal, Michael?
I don't know. That's a good question. And again, lots of good questions, but not really a lot of answers. And he's right. A few of my colleagues, they do not like Dennis and what he does. But he's absolutely right. No government agencies have come in and stopped him. The UN has chosen to just ignore him. But he is correct. The Outer Space Treaty does have a loophole because it says no governments can claim extraterrestrial ownership of the moon. Or the moon or asteroids. Dennis has latched onto the loophole in the fact that we haven't ratified the Moon Treaty, which the Moon Treaty basically says no private individual can own the moon or any other celestial body. See, that's the big catch with the Moon Treaty.
So could there be a legitimate battle down the road, let's say, from Dennis Hope's claim or stake on the moon?
It's kind of been addressed already. There was one court case back about 10 years ago called Nimitz. And basically what this gentleman did is he claimed the Eros asteroid. And NASA sent a probe up there around the year 2000 to orbit the Eros asteroid. And he actually landed on it and he tried to give NASA a parking ticket. And so, of course, NASA refused. And, you know, he brought it to court and actually got up, I believe, to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And his claim was, you know what, the Outer Space Treaty says we can own private property. We're not a signatory of the Moon Treaty. Therefore, it's not the law of the land in the United States, so I can do this. The court went through and just decided that nobody had the standing to actually give him the deed as well. They never really addressed really whether or not there was a loophole or whether the Moon Treaty was applicable law or not. Now, a lot of my colleagues just jump right on Nimitz. Oh, this is proof. My opinion is that until somebody takes him to court and actually determines once and for all that he can't do this, he's probably going to do well in business for the next few years.
Well, so there are a number of vagaries, but a number of other agreements, the rescue agreement, a registration convention in space.
Right.
Now, what I'm curious about, we mentioned the Cold War, and we remember, of course, we all remember the Strategic Defense Initiative, or so-called Star Wars shield that mm-hmm. President Ronald Reagan proposed. Never panned out. But what are the laws governing the use and placement of weaponry in space?
Basically, there are none. And this goes back to the Outer Space Treaty. And one of the other precepts that I didn't mention earlier was that space is to be used for peaceful purposes. Well, there's a wide range of opinions about what peaceful purposes means. There's a small percentage that believes peaceful purposes mean no military activity whatsoever. But the perception that's really accepted is that there can be military activity in outer space as long as it's for peaceful purposes. Here's an example. We all know about GPS. We have it in our cars. Right. We have it in our phones. We take it for granted, but GPS is actually a military program. The Air Force started the program for its own uses, and also as a benefit, as a side benefit, civilians around the world are able to use GPS on a less accurate signal. So technically, that's a military activity. Now, under a strict interpretation of peaceful purposes of no military activity, the Air Force could not have placed GPS in orbit, and we would not have the benefit of what we consider, you know, just an everyday convenience today.
So as technology is advancing, and obviously a lot more private industries and private companies are getting interested in space travel and space even colonization, obviously, there's some need for revision in these laws. What do you think the future holds for international space law?
I wouldn't say so much a revision as so much an evolution. Commercial space has been a huge issue for the past few years, to the point where we have private companies who are providing launch services to the government, to NASA itself. We also have companies that are doing suborbital flights to tourists. Now, this is interesting because now we're taking spaceflight laws out of the hands of the federal government and we're putting it into the individual states. So it's a game changer. We're definitely in new territory. We're going to be making a lot of new international law as this goes orbital, but I think a lot of it's going to be more what we call customary, as in law created through practice instead of law created through treaty.
Michael Lissner, president of the International Space Safety Foundation, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
You can discover more about international space law and hear our full interview with the alleged owner of the moon, Dennis Hope, at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, we remember musician, actor, and rambler Levon Helm a year after his death. That's when Word of Mouth continues in just a moment.